Art at the Northfield Arts Guild. Visit our galleries, arts festival, and take in a performance at our theater featuring a full season of dramas, comedies, and musicals. The Guild's gift shop showcases unique art from over 100 local and regional member artists. Come enjoy music from the Cannon Valley Regional Orchestra or the 411 Concert Series. We invite you to explore your creativity in one of our classes. All are welcome at the Northfield Arts Guild. To learn how you can be a part, visit northfieldartsguild.org or call 507-645-8877.
Art Zany, radio for the imagination, with your host Paula Granquist, is brought to you by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts. And now, Art Zany, radio for the imagination.
Good morning, this is Paula Granquist, and you're tuned in to Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination. Thank you so much for listening to the show that celebrates creating and stories, and we are going to tune our imaginations together today, and I'm so excited for this show. Our book club recently read a fascinating little book called Eastbound. We selected this book partly because we were reading it during the month of December and wanted to have a shorter book to read during the holidays. The book is by Maëlys de Kerengal, I hope I'm saying that correctly, and is translated from the French by Jessica Moore. The book tells the story of a young Russian conscript traveling by train across the vast Siberian expanse. During the marathon train ride, the soldier shares his anxieties about what lies ahead and what he sees out the windows of the train car. Then an elegant French woman gets on the train, and the adventure begins. They don't speak a common language, and yet this book gorgeously takes us into the train car with these two passengers that are headed into the unknown. The writing is glorious. It feels like the movement of the train. It's rich with tension. Their connection is palpable and engaging. The danger is heart-pounding, and the descriptions are vivid. It's an unusual little story, but it's a book that stays with you. The language is such that you want to finish the book and reread it again. And at book club, we talked about how this book might read in French. We wished we could read it in French. The question we kept asking ourselves was, how is a translator able to create this reading experience so masterfully in English? We were in awe of the beauty of the language. And I've always been in awe of people that can read, write, or speak another language. As a kid, I was fascinated with people that could talk to someone in one language and then turn to the next person and speak another language. I longed to have that skill, and I desperately wanted to learn Spanish. My mother took me to the library, and we tried to find ways to expose my sister and I to other languages. We had friends that were Polish, and I loved listening to them speak, but I didn't understand anything. My father traveled all over the world for his job, and we often had business guests from other countries visit our home. And these guests often wanted to speak and practice English, and I could understand how they wanted to make the most of the experience. And I do still wonder what they told their families back home about our family and our lives in Minnesota. So it's like they had access to something that I didn't have yet. I could pick up phrases of other languages, and I studied Spanish, but I never achieved the ability to jump from one language to another with fluidity. It's like my brain slows down, and I can't make the transition quickly between languages. I need to be in one world or the other, and not both. And I recognize that I have had the luxury of studying a language and not having to learn a new language in order to survive or function in another world. And I have great admiration for those who learn to live in a world of another language. So today we're going to explore that on Art Zany Radio. I am thrilled to be able to bring to you today the story of Moose versus Moose, the scandal that shook Norwegian America. I'll visit with Norwegian translator and teacher Torald Holmstad. This is a fascinating story that happened right here in southeastern Minnesota. The story captured the headlines in Minnesota and Norway back in the 1890s. Olene Moose is a woman that stood up for her rights and challenged her pastor husband and the church in Norwegian America. This examination of their legal and church cases dives into the experience of Norwegian immigrants in Minnesota and the place of the Norwegian Synod in the life of the new arrivals. It's a well-researched story. It reveals how the issues of immigration, assimilation, education, politics, the press, and gender roles shape the lives of the people here in America and back home in Norway. This is a great story about the place we live and has many of the issues that echo in our current cultural and political conversations. I want to go ahead and welcome to the studio my guest today, Torold Holmsted. Welcome to Art Zany Radio.
Thank you.
It's such a pleasure to have you. We've seen each other often at book events, and I haven't had a chance to get to talk to you. And then I went to this book event that you had a while back at Content and was just absolutely fascinated by this story. So I'm thrilled that you're going to be here to share with a little more about it. But you could start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and your work as a translator and kind of just introduce yourself to our listeners.
Thank you. What can I say?
Well, I could summarize a little bit, but tell us about the summer school, too.
Yes, I went to, I graduated from St. Olaf with a Norwegian major, believe it or not, and I eventually ended up working at the University of Oslo International Summer School, which has their North American admissions office here at St. Olaf. And I like to say that I am a living example of someone who turns out to have a Norwegian major as a very practical major. So it kind of flowed into my career.
That's incredible. I think people might be surprised that there's, you can major in Norwegian. That's something that there's not a lot of places that do that.
Not a lot of places you can do that.
In the States.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's something incredible about our town. And the book Muse versus Muse, The Scandal That Shook Norwegian America, is just an amazing story. And I wondered if you had read the, because it was originally published in Norway, in Norwegian. Did you read the original first?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes,
and we should mention that is by author
Bodil Stenseth.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, because I wouldn't have said it quite like that. And her interest is in sort of the culture of immigrants that come to America.
Yes, she started out thinking that she was going to write a portrait of like 12, I think, Norwegian Americans, and sort of get the Norwegian American experience in that way. And then she found Bernt and Olina Moose and thought they encapsulated so much of the issues of the immigrants that that she focused then her work on them.
Yeah, and so that's, you know, how it starts is that they're just an integral part of the development of that culture. And you worked with St. Olaf Norwegian professor Kari, is it Lee?
Kari Lee Daughter.
Daughter, mm-hmm. And because she's currently the chair of the Norwegian department.
That's correct,
at St. Olaf. And she kind of entered this story because she just was fascinated with it like I was, and she wanted to bring it for an English audience. And so I love the story that she tells in the afterword that I want to mention, because this kind of shows how integral he was to this place. Bernt Moose has a bust in
Old Main.
Yeah, and tell us what that today students walk past it all the time.
Yes, there's this bust of Bernt Moose, who is the founder of St. Olaf. In Old Main, as you come in before the entry is before the hallways split, and it's a bronze, dark bronze color, except for his nose, which is very shiny. And the reason that his nose is shiny is that students would rub his nose for good luck before they went in to take their exams.
I wonder how that started. Do you know?
I don't have any idea how that started, but it's a good. It's a good story.
It's a very funny story. So folks can go do that.
Yes.
Right now. It's his statue is, or it's just a little bust of him is up there. So you spend a lot of time with these characters. Olina, I'm glad you said that, because I had been saying it to myself while I was reading as Oline. Mm-hmm. So Olina, but it has an E at the end. Mm-hmm. And Bernt. How would you describe them? And what was it that, did you find a connection with them?
Yes, very much, although they both still puzzle me a little bit.
Mm.
Their story of how they got together and fell in love is very romantic, very sweet story, and then over the years, something happened. And it culminated then in this lawsuit,
mm-hmm.
which also points us to many of the issues in Norwegian America.
Right. And that's actually what I found most fascinating about the book was the way that it sets us up to understand that conflict. Because I think without the context, it makes it a little difficult to see it as monumental as it actually is. But I do want to start with how they fell in love. They're both in Norway at the time. And I don't know that she was particularly looking to become a pastor's wife.
I would say probably not. She was, she came from a very wealthy family. She was 6 or 7 years younger than he was, and he was going to seminary. But they met in Oslo, and they fell in love. And they had a common religious faith, which I think also contributed to their relationship mm-hmm. In the beginning.
Yeah, and they sent these love letters, which are something I think is fascinating that you had access to that those materials, that they exist today, I guess.
Yes, they do. Kari found many of them. Well, Buddha Stenseth, of course, found many of them.
Sure.
And as Kari began work with the subject, she found a lot more in different archives.
I think that's so fascinating that they would survive, and that you know that because for folks that aren't you know aren't familiar, it was back in the 1860s when
yeah.
they were first you know corresponding and communicating, and that's. Just to think that those survived, because a lot of that paper doesn't make it because of fires or just, you know, water damage or, you know, they get tossed.
Or they get destroyed.
Yeah, exactly. So that I think that's a beautiful part of the story. And I mean, they were really mushy. And they told stories and stories. And
very sentimental.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. It was quite lovely to hear how they developed that relationship. But then when they... one of the things that we should talk about is the role of the church in the community, because it was not like just a church. Like when we say the word church, sometimes we think of that as a place, you know, where you go to worship. But the church was really the hub of, especially here in America. I don't know if that was true in Norway as well.
In Norway, the church was very, very important. And the church was quite authoritarian.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that maybe comes out a little bit in the book, at least in the later years, in some of the conflicts that come up.
Yeah.
Is how much should the church control what we do, what we think,
mm-hmm.
how we behave.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, that was fascinating about this story and the church for... Olina is that she becoming a pastor's wife is a huge responsibility. It's a very honorable position. It was very well respected, but in the parsonages, it meant she had to really partner with in the work that they did at both the you know the church and then the home life and hosting people as well.
Right, and of course. When she married Bernd, she was young,
mm-hmm.
and she came from a wealthy background, so she was kind of, and she was the youngest child, so she was a little spoiled, and all of a sudden she had to be very responsible, and had to know all kinds of things. She had to manage a household. When she came here, she had to manage the farm.
Mm-hmm.
Supervise all of the workers,
mm-hmm.
and she had to know all these practical things like making candles and soap and, you know. Life on the prairie in the frontier, and it was not easy. And when she came also, I think that she probably did not expect that her life would be like it was, because she came... after this long, long and arduous journey and came to a place where she didn't even have a house.
Mm.
The first 6 months or more, They lived with another family in Holden. And she had no place of her own. And the house, of course, was a pioneer house, dirt floor probably, and not at all what she was used to.
Not probably not insulated, probably of minimal, you know, places to sit and
sleep.
And, yes.
Yeah.
What we imagine a house like that would have been back, which is just phenomenal. And this was 1859 that they came. And I was surprised that Berndt was sent as a Norwegian pastor representing the official Norwegian synod, and he needed to preserve the ways of the homeland church in the new land.
Right. Well, he was called by Holden. The people at Holden had organized themselves as a congregation the year before, but they had no pastor. And so he was the first, he responded to the call, and he was the first resident pastor in the Norwegian Synod. So he had also a huge responsibility, because before then, if somebody needed to be baptized or married, they would have to have a circuit riding preacher come. And, you know, sometimes these people would come and do sort of a mass baptism of all the babies born in the last year. And so he was responsible for, I think in the end, 28 congregations. And he baptized over 9,000 children in his career. And I don't remember how many people he married and buried.
Yeah, there were a lot.
But several thousand, yeah.
And so in that time, the thing that was interesting was there were a lot of Norwegian settlements. I mean, and they tended to stay together, which I think is common for immigrants to do. So what, I'm trying to remember from the reading, what was the population of Holden and where the church, the size of the church at the time? I don't remember.
I don't remember either the size of the church, but it was people from the place called Holden in Telemark. And then you can see from the names of some of the churches in this area where people came from. Because we have, besides Holden, there's Gul in Kenya and Hegre. Those are people from Gul, from Hallingdal. Hegre was from Trøndelag. And so they would band together. And one family would come, and then other families would follow.
Right. And so it was a very vibrant community. And the one thing that I found really fascinating, this, I think this is an important part of the story too, is that Berndt became known for his fiery and commanding ways of leading the church. There's a quote from the book, this is page 37, if you have, Moose versus Muse, the scandal that shook Norwegian America. During services, Pastor Muse preached in a way that he hoped would cause the congregation to feel shame and repent, or become so angry they would chase him away. But nothing happened. And he was, I think, surprised by that aspect of, and that was an element of, I think, some of the influences of the American culture that had started to affect the people here in our part of the world. Even though they clung to the religion, some of the ways of, you know, freedom of religion and speech had influenced them.
Well, he was definitely one of these hellfire and brimstone preachers. But that was, I think, fairly typical of a Norwegian church, because the pastor was the person who made sure that everybody behaved and had a lot of control over the behavior in the community. You know, you had to be, when you were confirmed, it had to be, you had to present yourself with, you had to show that you knew the catechism. And
they had a test they had to pass.
And if they didn't do well, or they didn't show themselves of the kind of character that the pastor wanted them to be, they would not get this letter of attest. And there were a couple of instances in the Gul congregation where people applied to become members, and they were turned down because they didn't have the proper credentials.
And that was because some of those came from the church in Norway.
They came from the pastor, or pastor in Norway that confirmed them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so they were very strict about some of those things. And I think that's kind of an important foundation for this story that we're going to reveal a little bit about here today. For folks just tuning in, this is Art Zaney, Radio for the Imagination. We're talking about Moose versus Moose, the scandal that shook Norwegian America. Originally by, and I'm going to have you say the name again,
Toral. Bodil Stenseth.
Yes, and then edited by Kari Lee Durer and translated by both her and you, Torald Olmstead, who participated in this book. And it's what I found fascinating about the story is that it's really an international story, but that has local roots for us. And maybe we could explain to our listeners a little bit about how local that story actually is. I think it's fascinating.
The church that Moose came to is Holden, which is 20-minute drive east of Northfield.
Holden isn't a city in
Holden is a township now.
Yeah.
And the church is Holden.
Okay.
But there used to be a post office there, and I think it was Norway was the name of this place where the post office was closed long since. But there are families still here that belong to Holden congregation that were there in the 1859.
Wow.
When Bernt Moose, Kari and I took a group of St. Olaf students who were working with her on this project to Holden one Sunday a couple years ago when we were still in the midst of it. And we interviewed a couple of people who had been there. Their family name was there since the very beginning, and they were founders. And there was, I met a person just recently where her ancestors were Langemo, who was one of the founders and plays quite an important role in the whole church case.
Wow. That's just, to me, those would have been some of the first people here in this part of the world.
In 1859.
Besides the indigenous folks.
Yes, in 1859, this was the wild frontier.
Mm-hmm.
A very wild frontier. This was the far west.
Yes, and so trying to imagine their life and the, you know, travails they had every day just to make it through the day and survive. And then in addition, they've got this work they're doing for the church community. And that church community was very fascinating as well. One of the things that we learn is that, and I don't know if this tradition must have come from Norway, that the men sat on one side and the women sat on the other side.
You know, that was very common in many churches.
That wasn't just the Norwegian.
I mean, the Puritan church.
Oh.
Also, there was the men's side and the women's side. And I was trying to figure out when that tradition might have ended. But I think it varied a lot according to the community and the country and the church.
Yeah, because now we sit with our families.
Yep.
But they did kind of have an order. So, if the man sat in a certain row, then the wife and kids sat in the same
right.
order of according to their position in the church.
Right. The most important people in the community sat in the front rows.
Mm-hmm.
The men on one side, the women on the other. And it went back to the least important or the poorest members of the congregation.
Yeah, and that's so interesting. I think about now, like, nobody wants to sit up front.
No.
You can have the first two rows are usually kind of
empty.
Sparsely populated. And so that's an interesting thing. That would have been the prime seat, the one you wanted. You wanted to be seen at church.
It indicated your status.
Mm-hmm. And Olina made quite an impression because I remember reading in here that, you know, her clothes would have been probably a little more fancy because she came from that wealthy family. And she was also known for her singing voice, which I thought was a lovely detail in here.
The hummingbird choir.
Yes. Yeah. She really encouraged that, and music was a part of her contributions. Mm-hmm. And so that would have been a valuable thing to have in the community. And the other thing, that having women separate was also a reflection of some of the structure of the church, because women didn't participate in the leadership, I guess, of the church.
Right. Their role in the church was very, it was important, but it was very subservient.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not allowed to speak. And that's one of the issues that comes out in the church case or hearings, is that they were talking about, they were discussing her behavior, deciding whether she should be disciplined by the church or not. And she was not allowed to speak. They assigned a man to speak for her.
And that's a huge part, because that was a part of the order of, that was, you know, they weren't allowed to be elected to the church council or to vote in any issues. It was just the congregation's men that could do that. It was the patriarchal order, and it was the process that it was, you know, ingrained in the way that they lived.
Exactly.
And so that was another element that becomes really important in the stories. And I wonder, when you thought that Alina started maybe wondering about that practice and kind of questioning that, I was thinking that she, you know, because she had this role as the pastor's wife, which was honored, but yet, so she was doing all the things and participating. She probably heard from her husband about, you know, things he had to do or decide. And maybe they didn't go to counsel for each other. I'm not sure. Because the marriage was also something where the woman was supposed to be
subservient.
Yes.
when he was gone in Norway, we had that long year when he was gone to Norway. And I think she really resented that, because she wanted to go. And she saw other pastors' wives traveling sometimes with their husbands. But mm-hmm. he wanted her to stay home. And she did all the faithful work in the church. And when there were issues, she often consulted with her husband's colleagues down in Decorah and in Wisconsin.
Right.
People that he knew and trusted. And she obviously trusted them in some respects also.
Right, because they would have been part of the organizational structure
of the synod.
Mm-hmm, and had to be aware of the things that were happening and all, mm-hmm. keep their eyes on everybody. mm-hmm. And she wasn't probably allowed to make a decision about something at the church without them.
Well, there was an issue about the drinking.
Oh, yeah.
Members of the congregation that were selling whiskey.
was a great story. Tell it.
And she actually went directly to them. First she got a male member of the congregation to go with her, mm-hmm. and say, you know, this isn't a good thing to be doing. You shouldn't be selling this liquor. And when that didn't work, she went directly to them. I don't know that it actually stopped the sale. I think she got a promise from one of the people who was selling whiskey that he would, after this barrel was gone, he wouldn't sell anymore.
Right. And sounds like she wasn't really convinced at that.
No.
But they were worried about that sort of affecting the, you know, the morality, the, mm-hmm. you know, the congregation, and becoming a problem mm-hmm. for them to have these, you know, guys who were selling whiskey.
And historically also, I mean, in not just in the church, but in the wider community, Stanset talks about how the whiskey merchants came in early. As soon as there was a community that was established, they came in and started to sell their wares.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. That would have been a crazy thing. And it would have been the gentlemen, the men who mm-hmm. were partaking and carousing and mm-hmm. not something that they wanted to have in their community. And so you talked about that, that pivotal moment in the story when Berent went back to Norway. That was 1870. Mm-hmm. And she desperately wanted to go back. And you think about that. She'd been there almost 10 years. And she hadn't seen anybody in her family. I think she'd written some letters to her sister. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that would be just, I mean, heartbreaking to you know, mm-hmm. not be able. And he wrote to her when he was over there about what he saw. And he was doing all these things. And he was in England and Denmark and, I mean, just everywhere. And that must have, and at that time they had children then.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so she was taking care of all the children and the house and the
and a farm.
Yeah. I was so sad for her.
Yes. And her, the woman, her maid or whatever, who had come, her parents had sent this woman with her to help her.
Yeah.
The first few years. And she had also gone back to Norway by that time.
So she really was all alone.
She was all alone, yeah.
And I just think that that for me was probably her breaking point, I think, you know, that really set her off. And I can imagine. And also during this time, I thought it was intriguing how all of the struggles about the church and their position on so many things that were happening in the outer world were coming back into the church, such as, you know, should laymen be able to preach? Mm-hmm. What about the Sabbath and how that should be handled? Slavery became a conversation and you know, whether that was something that the church should take a position on, parochial versus public education. I mean, and then one of the big ones that affected Berent Mus is predestination controversy. And that was about God chooses who will be saved. How did Pastor Mus deal with these debates?
Well, he had very strong opinions. Let's put it that way.
No doubt.
Yeah. And of course there were like five Norwegian synods in the Midwest at that time. And so the synods disagreed, on these issues themselves. And, I think that he would have said predestination because he would be one of those who would determine who was going to be saved.
Yeah.
And the whole slavery issue came out, of course. Holden congregation had sent a lot of young men to the Civil War to fight on the side of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
Pastor Moose's stance was a little in conflict with that because he compared the wife and the children's role in the household as a slave to their master.
Yeah, that gets tricky.
and yeah, that's very telling in a way, but that also comes out very much in the church case.
Mm-hmm.
Is who should does a wife have to be subservient in all things? What does in all things mean? And when Olina says you should be subservient or submissive if your husband's a good Christian husband, and if he's not, who are you as a person?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any kind of individuality at all? If you just have to agree to absolutely everything.
Yeah, there was a case, I think, was presented, I don't remember where in the story, about a woman whose husband was, you know, being abusive to her, and she went to live with her brother,
mm-hmm.
but the pastor came and said, you need to come back to your husband because that's your duty. I mean, it was just
heartbreaking.
Yeah, it breaks your heart to think about mm-hmm. how that doctrine was so essential to their structure of order and their...
Well, and of course, that was the way the world worked at that time.
True. It's not just in the church. Yeah.
There's a lot of... there's some stories about feminists in the East, and there was one story about a man whose wife disagreed with him on some theological matters, religious matters, And he sent her to the insane asylum.
Right, yes.
And it took her several years with the help of her adult children to get out of that situation. And I think that Olena, when it came to her, when it came to her lawsuit, you know, she had tried to convince Berndt that she was capable of handling her estate, her parents' estate, but in Norway, the husband had control of the finances, and he had received the benefit of her father's inheritance without ever even telling her about it. And so when she found out, she said, "You know, I want to handle this money. I want to contribute to the household out of my own funds." And he kept refusing. And so finally, she said, "Okay, I'm going to take you to court."
Right.
And by that time, I think they were both so entrenched in their own stubbornness that it was impossible to come to any kind of reconciliation.
Right, because that was what made the case so fascinating, was in Minnesota had just passed a few years prior that women had the right to own property and, you know, manage their financial affairs and inheritances in particular. But in Norway, that was not the case. They were not allowed to. Women, if they were given an inheritance, it went to their husband. And it went directly to the husband. There wasn't a question about it. And part of the complication of this is that both Berndt and Olena were still Norwegian citizens. And I wonder, there wasn't a lot in here about why they didn't apply for U.S. citizenship. I don't know if you have any other details.
The lawyer tried to avoid answering that question at all.
No, he did. He didn't want that to become a part of the case. Do you know any more about it?
I don't, but I suspect that maybe they just hadn't gotten around to it.
Yeah, that's true, because they probably had to travel.
Right, and they had all of the benefits of living in America, so they're probably, maybe they didn't feel the need to do that.
Or maybe they wanted to go back at some point. I don't know. That's another possibility.
That's another possibility, because when he'd spent that year in Norway, he was actually looking for a call. And they might have thought they might go back when they retired and go and live in Norway again. So I'm not sure that that's such a strange thing. No. I think a lot of people didn't bother.
Right, right. There weren't reasons for them, like you said.
Right.
But it became really critical to that case.
That was one of the things that became a very groundbreaking case in the U.S. Was, should Minnesota law apply because they were in Minnesota, or should Norwegian law apply because the inheritance came from Norway also? And obviously the court eventually agreed with Olena and her lawyer.
And the book takes us through this fascinating case, Moose versus Moose, the scandal that shook Norwegian America. And, you know, it's just so, and it's so interesting that we're given access to some of those conversations, because part of the complication here is that somehow Olena was in contact with a lawyer, and we there's speculation about how she was able to find that lawyer, and it might have been through the doctor in town, or through, you know, some of the speakers that came, you know, talking about some of the issues of the day or sharing news. But she contacted a lawyer to find out, well, do I have a case? Is there, you know, something here for me, given what I understand about the rulings in Minnesota as far as property? And then after she got a letter from him, she took that letter to another leader in the church and said, so do I need to bring this to the church? And that opened up the
right,
the
and
door.
He said, let sleeping dogs lie, more or less, and don't do this. Don't pursue this legally. You need to be a proper wife and
ask the congregation, really, because that was how things were handled. Mm-hmm. Let's keep it inside of our world, and you know we'll and they had a democratic process within the church,
more or less.
Yeah, I put that in air quotes. I guess that's not good on radio, is it? and they were able to have her. That's how they handled disputes or questions or discipline,
but. Nobody wanted to cross Pastor Moose.
And that's where it gets complicated.
And that gets it even more complicated.
And he was put in a position, too, because, you know, he was, do I hold this? Do I just, you know, shut it down? It's like it was already out there. And he was, you know, they had to do something.
They kind of couldn't stop it at that point.
No. And another aspect that made it so fascinating, and which I imagine as a translator was part of the sources that you were able to access, were all, there were so many newspapers, mm-hmm. and many in Norwegian.
Right. Well, that was one of the things that Kari found that she had to take a lot of time with, because, of course, the... some of the articles in the Norwegian American papers were obviously in Norwegian, but a lot of them were in English, because this case was really very, I should say, well covered in the press. And Stanseth, of course, had translated them into Norwegian for the Norwegian book.
And, oh, right. I didn't think about that she had the opposite version of what you were doing.
So then Kari found out, well, we can't just translate these back into English. We have to go to the originals. Mm. And so the ones that appeared in English in the English language newspapers, she had to find in the archives and put them in as they were written.
Yeah,
rather than having us translate them back.
Right, and that's a fascinating part about it. One, that those resources are available, and that the people just that was how they found out about. And so there were avid readers and mm-hmm. people that were super curious about this couple and their experiences. And one of the things I'm trying to remember the name of the lawyer sent a letter with. Olena, but he attached this appendix.
The complaint.
That's what it was called. Yeah, the complaint. And that's really what got everybody riled up. And there's questions about whether the lawyer intentionally did that, because that...
that made the... put the case out in the court of public opinion.
Right. And it sort of outlined the ways in which Olena was unfairly treated, or mm. the issues she had in her marriage, which, and I imagine at that time, that was a, you know, you do not bring that out, air your dirty laundry, right? As right. they say. And so that's part of what fascinated. So when they would hold these church meetings, which they made public, thousands of people came to hear what the debate was going to be and to get more details. And then the newspaper reporters all had their, that, this is, I think, a nice thing to think about our newspapers today, too. They all kind of had their angle they wanted to mm-hmm. Portray in this case. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that, you know, made a difference, that each one had an audience that they were speaking to?
Right. The Norwegian American papers, there was quite a prominent editor named Lute Jaeger, and he was a friend of Andreas Juland, the lawyer.
Mm.
And so I think in a way they kind of, Juland was a very smart young lawyer, and he knew that in order to influence the court, he had to get the public behind him. And I think that strategy of putting the letter, the appendix, it had no legal bearing on the case. And the judge said, this has no legal bearing on the case.
He like pushed it aside immediately.
But it did, of course, influence people greatly, because they took sides.
Right, because they talked about things about, you know, the household money that she was given mm-hmm. and the way she had to actually, in order to maintain the household, did sewing and embroidery and other jobs.
Earn money in other ways, yeah.
Yeah, in order to buy rugs and You know, firewood was not always, they weren't able to light fires in all the rooms. And it was like
a lot
of...
And then in the church case, they had members of the congregation who were witnesses on each side that would say, well, that was true. She didn't have enough money. And then somebody else would say, well, that's not true. She had plenty of money and she could charge things at the local grocery store and so on and so forth.
So you can see how this would just become great fodder for conversation and speculation and gossip. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if she ever thought that was where things were going to, you know, when she I feel like, I wonder if she just thought it was her duty to bring it to the congregation, but didn't imagine where it would go. Or do you think maybe she had some inkling of that?
It's hard to say what she knew would happen when this case blew up. But it was the congregation that decided that they had to have these meetings. I think she had hoped to just keep it in the legal realm and not bring it into the church. But that was... And there were a couple places, a couple times when she said, well, I'm not going to come to this church meeting because you're not going to listen to my side anyway.
Right. That was because we have to remember she was not allowed to speak.
Right.
And so she had to sit there and listen to all of this and know that she had no way to object or to correct or to even just expand on what somebody said. They all had their motivations.
Yes.
And she just had to mm-hmm. that must have been horrible. I can't even imagine. And that's part of what makes it fascinating is to think in terms of, you know, how that would feel and what position that put her in. And, oh, it's just an incredible story. And there's so many great details because all of the church meetings they had a secretary who was taking notes.
Right.
And which became a big issue. The notes were questioned the next day.
Oh, I didn't have time to copy everything over, he said.
So she was smart, I think, to know that I want to hear those notes before we approve them. And she did that through her representative, but they worked really hard to make sure that what was reflected in those minutes of the meetings were accurate or agreeable. Maybe that's a better
agreeable,
word.
Agreeable, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I love that fascinating part of the story. That was very smart. And that's why we can know about it. Otherwise, and they kept the meetings open too, because if they were closed, we would never know this story.
Right.
And it just became such a fascinating piece. And I think that... It like you said, it grabbed attention here, but also in Norway too. And so, what were the? Was it well known in Norway before this book was written, or was it like here where people didn't know the story?
Oh, maybe historians knew something about it, but I don't think it was. I don't think it was really well known in contemporary times. At the time, of course, it was a big deal.
Yeah, right. That would have been because they would have all, especially since he was traveling around there. So tell me about your job as translator. How were you able to work on this project, or how did you figure out what both of you were doing translating? And there was, I mean, obviously the sources were just a ton.
Kari originally told me, oh, I'm working on this translation. And would you want to be kind of a beta reader and proofread a little bit? And so I started out, and I found some issues with the way things were being done. And I think a lot of it was, again, the stanza sources, were they... you know, what they should be, were there some, I think there were some errors in dates that you could see there was a discrepancy. And I did know a little bit about the story from before and a little bit about the churches around here. And then I had been working a little bit on this. And Kari said, you know, I've got to do the research on the archives and see what other material is out there and find the English sources to some of these things that have been turned into Norwegian. And you're doing so much work on this. Let's make it a co-translating project. Mm-hmm. And so we spent well over a year working together on it.
I would imagine. And so what are the rules of translation? Because I'm thinking about how, you know, one, you have to kind of understand the world as it was in that time, that era, because, and even the language would be, you know, they must have had, you know, words that are no longer used, fancy ways of saying things, the structures of grammar and such that we don't use. Mm-hmm. And, you know, knowing the context of the cultural issues or the, you know, positions of people would have been important. I mean, there's a lot. It's not just, you know, punching a word into a computer and getting what you put in, come back out and have it done. It's much more subtle than that.
Well, it was so delightful to hear you talk about this book, Eastbound.
Yeah.
And the idea of translation, because there are some people say, oh, it's impossible to translate. You know, you can't ever come up with something that is accurate. And I think that idea is so sad to me, because then if you can only read and appreciate something in your own language, you've lost a treasure.
Yes.
Of literature and information that comes from another language, another culture.
You're right.
And I think, that does mean that translation is easy.
Well, because there are versions where it's, you can tell, and like, this one maybe is not such a good translation. And one of my favorite things is to look at poetry and have the English and the Spanish version together. And I like to just see, and sometimes you can look at different versions of the translation. And you're like, this one is much better. But it's not like I can pinpoint what that does.
Right, right.
And so, you know, tell me about your work putting...
With this book, of course... We've got three voices, basically. You've got Stenseth's voice as the author, mm-hmm. and you have both Berndt's voice and Olina's voice. And I think what we worked really hard on was to be authentic with all of those voices and yet make it readable for a contemporary reader.
And I think you've achieved that, because I was racing through it like, oh my gosh, this is really interesting, and the case is interesting, and the context and the cultural things are fascinating, and then the pieces of the recent, you know, the history that you found that support the story are incredible. So I think it's a book that a lot of people would enjoy.
I hope so. Mm-hmm. I hope so. I think I found it very compelling and you dig deeper and deeper into the issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really happy, as I think both as a translator and maybe as an editor also, it's important to have a little knowledge of a lot of things.
Yes.
So that you know kind of what you don't know and you can look into and say, I don't think that this church was named after Ibsen's Nora, because Ibsen's Nora came out, Doll's House came out right about this time, and I don't think it would have been available in English. So then you go and look up the church history, and you see, oh yeah, I was right. It was named after something else.
Yes, yes, and that's, so having that context of, you know, the current, you know, what else was happening with newspapers and stories and histories of that. That's mm-hmm. essential to the job. Are there rules of translation? I mean, what makes good translation? What, you know, as you're doing it, how do you know that you're like, this is okay, I got this paragraph done?
There are different rules from different people.
Mm.
I think there are some people who feel that translation should be literal, or as literal as possible. And those are people who say, well, you have to translate word for word.
Ah.
And I would prefer to say translation should be accurate to the tone and to the feeling and to the ideas.
Right, because even if you translate a word and then you put it in one language, it's I'm mimicking. I don't know why the word butterfly came to my mind. Especially when you're saying things like butterflies in your tummy, right? Mm-hmm. And they might use a different phrase over there. So if you did it literally, it doesn't work.
We say sleep like a log.
Yes.
In English, in Norwegian, it's sleep like a stone. So
that's a good example.
That's kind of an example of how it works, and especially with poetry. That can be really difficult. I've done some translations of poetry, and there you want to get a little bit of the cadence. You can't rhyme.
No.
But you can get kind of the rhythm of the words.
Right, and the beats and the all of the different elements that go into creating sort of the verse and the structure that the poet intended, but you can't get it perfect. But it gives us access, like you said. If we didn't have translators, we wouldn't be able to understand or read those things.
And of course, you know, we think about language and how important language is. And that also is a little bit at the heart of this story, is that how connected the Norwegian language was and how important it was to these early immigrants.
Right, they didn't give it up.
No. And, you know, the last things that people give up in an immigrant culture are usually faith and food. And that faith issue comes in also in terms of the language. People felt, these immigrants felt that their faith had to be transmitted to their children in Norwegian because that was what they had learned. They had absorbed their faith in the Norwegian language.
Mm-hmm. And that's an important element in the book, too. We could talk for another hour, I think.
Yes, I know.
There's so much.
I think we just got started.
I know. I feel like we did, too. I just adore this book, Torold. I appreciate you coming in and sharing your story with us. And I want people to be sure to pick up Moose versus Moose, the scandal that shook Norwegian America. It's available at Content and probably as well other locations, bookstores and history centers. And you can pick up a copy. It's a readable, lovely. I adore the fact that in the end, she ended up with a coffee shop, Olena, in South Dakota. And so you can find out how that happened if you read the book. It's just fabulous. So thank you.
Thank you.
We'll keep talking. Folks, this is Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination. I hope you enjoy your imagination and always remember to add some Art Zany to your life.
You've been listening to Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination, with your host, Paula Granquist. Art Zany is brought to you each week by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts in Faribault. The Paradise Center for the Arts is a vibrant cultural and artistic gathering spot in historic downtown Faribault. The Paradise is committed to offering high-quality visual and performing art opportunities for Faribault and our region. Regular events spotlight some of the best artists and musicians in our area and throughout Minnesota and the Upper Midwest. Our beautifully restored facility includes art galleries, classrooms, clay and textile labs, a gift shop and rehearsal spaces, in addition to a 300-seat auditorium. Visit ParadiseCenterForTheArts.org for a full schedule of events or call our box office at 507-332-7372. 7372.